Jaya.
As deserved.
Upakalpata apachita
apachitahi, being worshipped.
Priyavrata Naradayaho.
In the presence of Priyavrata and Narada. Avishyamam, without aversion. Avishyamikshavanayaho. Looking on. Atmasam.
Just suitable for his position.
Avastanam.
To his abode.
Avakmanasam.
Beyond the description of mind and words.
Shayam.
The planet.
Avyavaritam.
Extraordinarily situated.
Pravartayan.
Departing.
Agamat.
Returned.
Translation.
Lord Brahma was then worshipped by Manu, who respectfully satisfied him as well as he could.
Priyavrata and Narada also looked upon Brahma with no tinges of resentment.
Having engaged Priyavrata in accepting his father's request, Lord Brahma returned to his abode, Satchaloka, which is indescribable by the endeavor of mundane mind or words.
You repeat, Lord Brahma was then worshipped by Manu,
who respectfully satisfied him,
as well as he could.
Priyavrata and Narada also looked upon Brahma
with no tinges of resentment.
Having engaged Priyavrata
in accepting his father's request,
Lord Brahma returned to his abode, Satchaloka,
which is indescribable by the endeavor
of mundane mind or words.
So purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Manu was certainly very satisfied that Lord Brahma had persuaded his son Priyavrata to take the responsibility for ruling the world.
Priyavrata and Narada were also very satisfied, although Brahma had forced Priyavrata to accept the management of worldly affairs, thus breaking his vow to remain brahmachari and completely engage in devotional service. Narada and Priyavrata did not look upon Brahma with resentment.
Narada was not at all sorry that he had been frustrated in making Priyavrata a disciple.
Both Priyavrata and Narada were exalted personalities who knew how to respect Lord Brahma.
Therefore, instead of looking upon Brahma with resentment, they very feelingly offered him their respect.
Lord Brahma then returned to his celestial abode, known as Satchaloka, which is described here as being impeccable and being unapproachable by words.
It is stated in this verse that Lord Brahma returned to his residence, which is as important as his own personality.
Lord Brahma is the creator of this universe and the most exalted personality within it.
His lifetime is described in Bhagavad Gita, in the 8th chapter, text 17, Sahasra Yuga Paryanta Mahar Yad Brahmano Viduhu.
The total duration of the four yugas is 4,300,000 years, and when that is multiplied 1,000 times, it equals 12 hours in the life of Brahma.
Therefore, we cannot factually comprehend even 12 hours of Brahma's life, to say nothing of the 100 years that constitute his entire lifetime.
How then can we understand his abode?
The Vedic literatures describe that in Satchaloka there is no birth, death, old age, or disease.
In other words, since Satchaloka is situated next to Brahmaloka, or the Brahman effulgence, it is almost as good as Vaikuntha Loka. Lord Brahma's abode is practically indescribable from our present status. Therefore, it has been described as avan manasa goshara, or beyond the description of our words and the imagination of our minds. The Vedic literature has thus described the abode of Lord Brahma. Yadvai pararajam tat uparameshjam cha uparameshjam dhana yatra shokana jada namrachurnartirna chodvegaha. In such a loka which is situated many millions and billions of years away, there is no lamentation, nor is there old age, death, anxiety, or the influence of enemies. Okay? So, Om Gada Timidanda Shah, Gunanjana Shlakaya Chakshur and Meditam Yena, Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So, of course, what's being described here, as we described yesterday, too, is a etiquette within a hierarchy. Everyone knows what a hierarchy is? Hierarchy basically means there's lower, higher, and then all the way at the top, there's someone at the top. And of course, in our Krishna conscious hierarchy, you have Ishwara Parama Krishna, Sachidananda Vigraha, Anadir Radir Govinda Sarva, Karna Karanam. Krishna is at the top. So, there's, in this material world, there's natural hierarchies, and there are unnatural or imposed hierarchies. Unnatural means it's just imposed by a particular culture. And, in fact, the person who appears to be higher than the other persons in the hierarchy is not actually more qualified. An example of an unnatural hierarchy would be the ritualistic Brahminical understanding, the caste system. The caste system was something that appeared in the modern day and age as a perverted reflection of the Varnashram system. Varnashram system is you have the Brahmin, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras, and of course the Ashrams, Brahmacharis, then Grahasthas, those who get entangled. And then Vanaprastha, those who are disentangling themselves. And then Sannyas, those who are free. So, anyway, that's an interesting description of the four ashrams. So that you had this natural hierarchy, which is the Varnashram system. What do I mean by natural? It was based upon people's guna and karma, according to Krishna and the Gita. Chaturvarna mayashustam, guna karma vibhagasham. In other words, according to one's quality, one would be considered to be a Brahmin or a Kshatriya or Vaishya or Shudra. And that later on became transformed into the caste system, which was something more or less that by birth you would be considered a Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra. And later on that caste system broke down into many subcastes that even within, let's say, the Brahminical caste, you'd have like 10, 20, or 30 different subcastes. And some places you go in India, like Gujarat, for example, they're very much into subcastes. Many, many subcastes, and I don't know the names of them. And you have to marry someone, if you're going to get married, if you're that fortunate, and you have to marry someone within the same caste, and same subcaste. And if you don't do that, your parents will basically reject you. And I've seen that happen before. And the parents will actually force people to get married to someone who is completely unqualified, whether spiritually, materially, or not even a compatible match, just because they happen to be in the same caste. I have one friend in New Zealand, and his parents took him to India. This is from the Gujarati family. Parents took him to India, and they forced him to get married to this girl who... Not to criticize the girl, whatever. But it was, he just sat there at the marriage ceremony completely morose, like, why is this happening? Because he went along with what his parents wanted. I mean, that's another thing that's happened in the Vedic culture. You have this artificial imposition of
authority and, you know, guilt trips and everything like that. And it's like blind following, that you have to listen to your parents no matter what. And that's not really a fact. I mean, even with the guru, Prabhupada said, blind following and absurd inquiries are condemned. And Prabhupada very much, as I mentioned the other day, Prabhupada very much appreciated Tamal Krishnamurti, and Tamal Krishnamurti was anything but a blind follower. He would sometimes even argue with Srila Prabhupada. So anyway, so this is, you know, it's a very artificial, hierarchical understanding. So therefore, this poor boy, he was forced. He was sitting there, you know, a three-day marriage ceremony, wearing the, in the Indian marriages, you wear this crown on your head or a turban, you know, all this. It's really interesting. And then they hire a rickshaw with big speakers on it. You ever seen this? A big speakers and, you know, like a, even a Western band. You seen that? They have a Western band with trombones and trumpets and everything like that in the modern day in Asia. They're going through the street. Boop, 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 boop. I mean, in India, there's actually wedding seasons. And there's actually some seasons where you're not allowed to get married. I mean, they get very ritualistic. There's this Pitapak. You've heard of Pitapak? Which we're entering into right now. Which is where you're not supposed to worship Krishna or the demigods or anybody. You're supposed to worship, you know, your pitas, you know, your forefathers. It's really, it's weird. They take all these things out of context and make them rituals and stratify, you know, the whole life. And then the next month after Pitapak is a Devapak, right? Where you're supposed to worship the demigods. And so I was in Fiji and I was joking. I said, this month is Sannyasi Pak. Where you're supposed to not worship anybody but sannyasis, give all your money to the sannyasis. And they didn't listen to me. So and so sometimes they actually close, during this Pitapak, they actually close the altars. They don't worship Krishna, the demigods, or anybody. What? They just eat boga. You know, they offer to the forefathers. And sometimes they're offering meat to the forefathers, too. I mean, it's a completely crazy thing. I mean, so many Hindu rituals have come up that have nothing to do with the Vedic culture. Not only the caste system. Yeah, they actually... there's another thing, Rakshabandha, you know, big thing, where it's a particular time where you, where the, anyway, people go up, like the girl goes up to the boy and puts a little string around his wrist and says, now you're my brother. Like that. And the poor boy, you know, just like. Anyway, it's something that Prabhupada said is a complete concoction. And we don't do that in the Krishna conscious movement, although we find devotees so attached to their previous, you know, samskaras, that they actually keep doing these things. They follow Pitapak. I mean, it was interesting, you know, even in amongst my own disciples in Fiji, you know, I have to just like strong arm them to convince them not to follow Pitapak, to convince them to worship Krishna during this month. So, what's interesting, we have our Purushottam Mass, where you're not supposed to worship demigods or anybody except for Krishna, which is interesting. So we also have our month, but that's not just some ritual. So getting back to the point of the this poor boy, he was actually forced to marry someone of his own caste, and she definitely wasn't qualified or wasn't compatible. So he gets back. Marriage took place in India. So he gets back to New Zealand with his wife, and he says, actually, I can't stand you. Anyways, he says, actually, it's not going to work out. And so it turns into a whole disaster. Everyone's freaking out because of reputation. And he wants to send the girl back to India, and she can't go back to India because if she goes back, you know, the whole thing. She goes back to India. And her husband's rejected her, you know, just like her life is finished. So then everybody has to get together to arrange for her visa in New Zealand. And they even claim that he abused her, which he didn't, just so she could have a visa in New Zealand, PR, it's called a
A PR means you have a residency permit. It's like a green card. That's what they call it in New Zealand. So they have to go through this whole song and dance just because of this caste thing. And the girls, anyway, the caste that they were members of is called the Prajapati caste. Prajapati means the caste that makes a lot of children. But it has nothing to do with reality. It's just weird, this whole caste consciousness. I mean, again, it comes to such an extent that, as we were talking about on Sunday, that they won't allow people who are actually Krishna conscious into certain temples because they're not Hindus or they don't have the right caste. They wouldn't even allow the Prime Minister of India one time into one temple because she was a Parsi, which is, you know, something a little different. It's not precisely Hindu. They wouldn't allow her into Tirupati or into Jagannath Puri. So it gets really weird. It's really, really weird. So this is an artificial hierarchy. And so, of course, for many, artificial hierarchies are actually quite good because they're good for economic development. Like if you happen to be born in a Brahmin family, that's fantastic because then you can charge a lot of money for doing what's called pujas. Incidentally, don't pronounce the word puja as puj. Puj means stool. Puja means worship. So it's interesting in Sanskrit, you know, pronounce the word a little different. It means something absolutely the opposite or something weird. So don't say we're going to do puj today. We're going to do puja. We're going to worship the deity. So it gets to the point that you have this artificial imposed hierarchy, and people really buy into it because it gives them a superior position in society whereby they can make money, exploit others. And that's what really happened. You know, the so-called Brahmin caste thought, hey, we're Brahmins, so our children are going to be Brahmins. Like Prabhupada said, this is ridiculous, Prabhupada said, because it's like saying, because my father was a surgeon, therefore I'm a surgeon too, a qualified surgeon. You know, I know plenty of people who have children and they are doctors, and I wouldn't let the children even put a Band-Aid on me. What to speak of operate, isn't it? I mean, it's crazy. You know, my father, you know, for example, my father was a businessman. I'm not a businessman. Or even it got to the extent, in ISKCON actually one time, there was one devotee who was a temple president. Cat? They had to let him listen to class. He needs it more than anyone else. So it got to the point there was a devotee who was in charge of a particular temple. It was Gita Nagri, actually, many years ago. I'm not going to mention his name. It was when Prabhupada was on the planet. And he kept telling his son, you know, when I get older and retire, this temple will be yours. You know, this is weird. You know, this whole hereditary thing. And even, you know, it's a very great contamination. It even has entered into ISKCON, too, to a certain extent. You know, you think that my children will take over. You know, I'm a sannyasi, so my son, how a sannyasi had a son, that's a different thing. But anyway, so my son will also become a sannyasi. I'm a GBC, my son a GBC. You know, whatever, my son the guru. So it got to such an extent in India that, a little bit of Indian history, that there was a revolt against these brahmanas. And what happened is they made other religions to revolt against the brahmanas, like the Buddhist religion, Jain religion, and people, sometimes they just went to the forest to get away from the brahmanas. The brahmanas were interested in making money. You know, you had a whole list. If you want, I mean, people are really into samskaras. I mean, it's really interesting. I just got an email from Australia said, as soon as you arrive, you know, as soon as you arrive, we have a name-giving ceremony. And what else we have? Oh, yeah, we have a ceremony to give grains. And then after that, we have a ceremony, just one day, you know, I'm just flying in an airplane. You know, completely exhausted, like 20-something hours from here to Sydney. And you arrive there, and all of a sudden there's a name-giving ceremony for a little petunia. Your name is Petunia Devi Dasi. And then at night, yeah, there's this, you know, so three or four things in the day. Nobody's thinking I have to take a little rest. And then at night, there's a safe delivery ceremony. And we're not talking about UPS, you know, so, yeah. Or FedEx. You know, I'm not inaugurating the FedEx office in Sydney. That means, you know, a lady's going to give birth, so you got to go through the whole safe delivery, you know, Om Safe Deliveraya Namaha. Yeah. So, and it's at someone's house, and you know, big ceremony, all the friends come, and here I am, you know, just like after flying 24 hours, hardly aware where I am. And so, yeah, so people really, what I'm saying is people in that culture really into ceremonies and samskaras and, you know, blessings, you know, bless us. And it gets exhausting, all the blessings after a while. So, I mean, I do it because it's my service. So, imagine if I started charging for all these things. Good idea, actually. But imagine if that was my family business, you know, which would be crazy. Sannyasi is not supposed to have family business. So, and imagine if I could have a monopoly. Monopoly is not just the game you play when you're young, you know, Park Avenue and Broadway. You know, I don't know if you ever, anyone here played Monopoly when they were young? Yeah. You know, that's a typical American game. You're learning to be a businessman. You know, instead of playing Krishna or some games with Krishna, they actually play how to play the stock market and cheat and everything like that. I mean, that's a game that all the young Americans play. So therefore, the Brahmanas, they thought, well, we can have a monopoly. No one else can become a Brahmin unless they're actually born in a specific Brahminical caste family. And we can become very rich. So the Brahmins became very rich. People revolted against them and even founded different religions. We mentioned before the Buddhists, Jain, and the people went to the forest just to get rid of them, get free from the Brahmanas. So, but still in India, you have all these ritualistic things and ritualistic consciousness and artificial hierarchies. And even even a few years ago, even now to a certain extent, they have this sati rite that's imposed on women. It's a very artificial thing. You know, that means if your husband dies, then you're thrown into the fire. That's very artificial. I mean, if the woman wants to jump in the fire because she loves the guy so much, I mean, which is highly unlikely in Kali Yuga, but, you know, most ladies would like to throw the guy into the fire. You know, you're old. We got to replace you. Instead of burning weeds, they burn the husband. Anyway, So, it's imposed on people. It's just so artificial. I mean, and we have a tendency to become ritualistic, artificial, and sometimes that tendency can be exploited by others, as in the case of the ritualistic Brahmanas, and sometimes it just disconnects us from our real self. And we just get into all these rituals, like Krishna consciousness. We have all these different little rituals we do, you know, genuflection. Oh, no, that's the Catholic Church. No, I'm just joking. And we forget about the actual, you know, real thing, which is getting into chanting Hare Krishna and hearing Krishna Katha. Like when Maharaj Parikshit found out he was cursed to die in 7 days by the bite of the snake bird, he didn't go to Sukadev Goswami and ask for to learn all the rituals. In fact, you know, he actually asked, you know, what is it one's duty? It's interesting. He asked, what is one's duty when one's getting ready to die? And Sukadev Goswami first replied, guess what, buddy? Not buddy, king. Everyone is getting ready to die at every moment. I mean, that's, you know, the king was thinking, I'm in a special situation. You know, I'm going to die in 7 days. And Sukadev Goswami said, guess what? Everybody's in the same situation. But you're fortunate. You know you're going to die in 7 days. Whereas most people, they don't know when they're going to die.
Unless you have some terminal illness, you can predict it. Not to the day, but at least the rough prediction can be there. But they don't know when they're going to die. You're fortunate. I mean, sometimes devotees like Maharaj Katvanga, they want to know when they're going to die. They actually ask, he asked the demigods, when am I going to die? And they said, pretty soon, next moment. And he just went and took shelter of Krishna. So that was the discussion. So Maharaj Pariksit didn't ask to learn all the mantras and mudras and everything like that. He just sat down and heard Hari Katha, Krishna Katha, culminating with the pastimes of Krishna in Vrindavan. So that's a commentary on Indian culture, this very artificial hierarchy. But when you have a natural hierarchy means when someone is more qualified. I'll give you an example of a natural hierarchy that goes against the imposed hierarchy. And the example is, again, Shukadeva Goswami. Shukadeva Goswami was only 16 years old, and he was just born when he was giving class to Maharaj Pariksit. I mean, usually when a kid's just born, you tell him, you know, behave yourself. Or stop crying, at least. Very few instances where you would consider a newborn child to be in a superior position. Let's say someone was born at 16, which is Shukadeva Goswami, who was kind of highly unusual birth. But you can imagine someone just born, without putting on any clothes, sitting on the Vyasasana. It's interesting. Actually, in this movie, the Krishna series, they actually put clothes on Shukadeva Goswami. But actually didn't have any clothes. And because he was innocent. He had no concept of any material consciousness because he was basically Radharani's servant. Radharani's parrot. That's another story. So he sat there, and in the audience were all these older sages, including his father, you know, Narada Muni, people who were, let's say, in one sense, from an external viewpoint, in a superior position to him. Yet because he had that knowledge, therefore, he was accepted as the spiritual master, you know, the Siksha Guru, of all the sages there. For 7 days, they sat and listened to him. It's interesting, isn't it? So that's sort of a natural hierarchy, that we accept someone, not on the basis of how old they are, their body, although we're aware of that, but we accept someone based upon their knowledge of Krishna consciousness. As Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, that if one knows the science of Krishna, Margai Guru Hoi Tore Desh, that one knows the science of Krishna, he can be accepted as guru. Kiva vipra, kiva nyasi, shudra kenanaye Krishna takvaveta. What is that? Say guru hoy. If one knows about Krishna, that person can be accepted as a guru. And it doesn't matter how old they are, young they are, or like we're having this whole discussion in ISKCON right now about lady gurus. Lady gurus. I mean, that's interesting. How about spiritual gurus who happen to have an external body that's a lady? No, the body's not a lady. But anyway, female body, whatever you might call it. So there's this whole discussion right now where I'm recommending one lady. She's a very nice lady. Her name is Narayani. I don't know if any of you heard Narayani. Very nice. What? Here? No, she's never been here. Oh, very nice. I mean, I've known her for many years. And as far as knowing the science of Krishna, she can run circles around about 99% of all the men, including the gurus. If you read her history, she learned Sanskrit, how to read Sanskrit in one day. And then she learned how to read Bengali in another day. I mean, the lady's brilliant. And she was working with Prabhupada. Prabhupada was dictating, and Prabhupada, she was writing, taking notes in Bengali and Sanskrit from what Prabhupada was saying. So
you read her history, I mean, and she's giving Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vaibhava, Bhakti Vedanta courses, and, you know, no fault. I mean, her husband left her, got married to some other lady, and then he, whatever. You know, there's this interesting history in many ISKCON marriages that would make good fodder for soap operas. So, as the temple turns, you know, like there's this soap opera on TV, as the world turns, so we can say, as the temple turns, you know, where is Devadasi today? Has she run away with Brahmachari so-and-so? Will they find out about the romance in the kitchen? So, so anyway, I mean, she's a completely, like, sinless lady, joined the movement. I read her history and think, you know, she's not qualified. I'm ready for the glue factory. So, you understand the glue factory. That's where they said horses. And so, reading about that, and then it's so difficult to propose her as a guru for ISKCON. And then you got many of the Indian leaders who are stuck in this sort of, like, we're talking about this artificial hierarchy, artificial bodily distinction, thinking, you know, if you make a woman guru, we're out of here, you know, threatening like that. And I'm thinking, you know, she's so qualified. You know, it's okay. And it's just, you got this, you know, chauvinism, rampant chauvinism. And it's really based on the same thing that the Brahmanas were basing their caste consciousness on. Like, because they have a feeling of superiority. I mean, forget about the financial aspect. You know, that's neither here nor there in this particular context. But, you know, men like to feel, you know, there's this whole male thing. Women too, also. You know, everyone has a false ego, not just men. So, people like to feel, you know, they don't like to take instructions from others. They like to feel they're superior. They know everything. You know, I'm not going to get into details about my interactions with people like that. I mean, you can't really tell people anything. Because it just, you have to, like tiptoe around people sometimes to give them instructions. You know, tiptoe. Tiptoe through the tulips. You know, you have to tiptoe around, you know, and you have to say, oh, would it be a good idea if you did something like that? You don't have to do it. Actually, your way is probably better, but would you be willing to try my way? Pretty please? With sugar on top? You know, anyway. So really, when, you know, it's really hard to correct people. I mean, here you see in this verse, you know, and purport, Narada Muni is being corrected. He wanted to make Priyavrata sannyasi. And his guru, Lord Brahma, says, no way, Jose. You know, you have to, he has other responsibilities, and Narada Muni is accepting it. You know, there's no false ego. That's the point. But people have this false ego, you know. They want to keep themselves in an artificially superior position. Even whether they're qualified or not is another question. We're not even talking about qualification. But they want to keep themselves. So that's a lot to do with the male chauvinism. Is that they want to, you know, we want to feel superior. Whether we're not or whether we are is not important, but we are superior. Just by dint of having a particular type of body. And that's weird. That's an artificial hierarchy, isn't it? It's artificial. So you don't want that. I mean, if someone is actually superior, whether they're a male, female, or even a cat body, you know, you have to give the credit to cats sometimes. I mean, even Krishna, I mean, had an incarnation. There was one demon called Hayagriva, but Krishna also had an incarnation called Hayagriva, in which he spoke the Vedic knowledge from a horse's mouth. Pretty good, isn't it? I mean, who's going to accept a horse as a guru? A bunch of horse manure. So, anyway. I mean, but Krishna appeared as a horse, or Krishna spoke the Vedic knowledge as a fish. You know, that's pretty interesting. You know, Krishna speaks the Vedic knowledge in all sorts of incarnations and like that. So therefore, one should accept spiritual knowledge or, you know, guru from any caste, or whether someone's a man or a woman or a child, like Sukadeva Goswami, a kid, 16 years, you know, it's just a teenager. Isn't it? You know, if I see a teenager, I say, you're just a teenager, you know, go and do something practical, like worship your guru. Anyways, so we always like to, anyway, so we have to get rid of this false ego where we feel superior, whether we're men or women. Women also get into this thing, you know, they're superior. I'm an older devotee. And even people get into the guru thing. I got a better guru than you, haha. You know, that's weird. It's just this whole false ego, feeling of superiority, lording it over others, the same thing that got us into the material world. You know, I am the enjoyer, I am the creator. And we just like projecting it into our understanding and practice of Krishna consciousness. That's really what's happening. And we have to be able to identify internally when that false ego is rearing its ugly head. You know, am I acting out of false ego, or am I actually acting out of what Krishna wants? That requires intelligence. Very few people have intelligence. By intelligence, I mean the ability to examine the mind to see if the mind is acting properly. I mean, you got to divide yourself between the mind and the intelligence. I mean, the mind wants to do so many things. You know, sometimes we want to punch someone, and the intelligence. Anyway, I was just with someone yesterday. He said, "Don't put me in this situation. I may want to punch the person." And I said, "You know, you have to make your intelligence strong so you know what's the right thing to do. That's the difference between a human and an animal. Like an animal doesn't have that intelligence. That sort of it has intelligence, but not that sort of intelligence." You know, it acts on impulse. And the impulse is, you know, there's a certain type of intelligence and impulse, but it's not that able to control their senses like a human being. So, any other questions? Yeah. Yeah, quick. We got one half a second. Whether they experience resentment, you have to analyze, you know, where's that resentment coming from? I mean, certain times the resentment may be appropriate. And sometimes it may be just because, you know, I want to put myself as superior to them and they show themselves to be better than me. I mean, it just depends. I mean, there's many reasons why resentment may come. Appropriate resentment means when someone, I have some service and someone kicks me out of the way, you know, inappropriately, and they take over my service. You know, there's things like that. You know, it's a type of resentment that we feel upset that we had a right to our service and someone has taken away our service. Like someone goes on Sankirtan, they took away your service. Like if I go to Chapel Hill and start selling cookies during Christmas, and you get resentment.